Welcome to this sample audio clip, which comes from the series entitled Multi-Hull Conversations with Jim Brown. In this recording, Jim speaks to multi-hull sailor and windsurfer Bruce Matlack. Bruce shares some funny stories out of his experiences and life around boats. You can find out more about this historic audio series at www.outrigmedia.com.
Can you give us some kind of a thumbnail biography regards to your sailing in general? Not all of it's been multi-hull, but I guess some of it has, huh? Ocean sailing.
Yeah, well, similar to you. After I just read your last two books here, as I my beginnings were in monohulls too. I don't know if you want to call it Chinese junk a monohull, but loosely, I guess it is. But I started off. I read a couple of books, Kon-Tiki and the Tahiti Nui, which were both raft trips. One, of course, much more well known than the other. But I got excited about sailing to the South Pacific, and I didn't know much about sailing. I just sailed a sailfish, but I decided I was going to do it. And I knocked on doors till I found a ride and took off. Flew to Mazatlan and got on a boat called the Galilee with Julian Ritter. That's a story I hope to put in writing someday. But then I went down with him to as far as Costa Rica, to Punta Arenas. And that's when I figured out he couldn't navigate with a sextant, because I think I saw a picture of him, or I saw him had one upside down and backwards. And even as a young kid, I kind of thought something was wrong. So I jumped onto a powerboat, and he went off and eventually got to Tahiti, but I'll finish that story later. Then I got on a powerboat, the PGM. We didn't know what it stood for, but we always called it the Pray God We Make It, because we never knew what was going to happen next on that boat. And a single screw, the Gemi 671, and we ended up going through the canal and then putting it on the reef at San Andreas Island at night, and damn near wrecking it. And then ended up in Nicaragua and got in all kinds of trouble with the government, breaking up a missionary meeting and all that kind of stuff, which I've told you that story. But then from there, I got some money out of the U.S. Consulate there that my father had sent, and they made me promise to go back to L.A., and so I took it all for Panama, hitchhiked through the jungle, no visas, nothing, went around into the jungle to get back into Panama, into the canal zone, where I was safe, and looked for another ride. And then I found a ride on the Chinese junk came pulling in to Panama City, the Cristobal Yacht Club there. And they were kicking the guy off, and I signed on. Off to sail back, off to Tahiti. No,
hey.
Yeah, well, how far is that? 5,000 miles. Don't worry about it, kid. Get on, you know. So off we went. No motors, no outboards, no life jackets that I know of, no radio. Just go, and with this English skipper named Alex Roper, and six of us total in a crew. 30 days later, we ended up in Nukuhiva, and then left Nukuhiva and pulled into Papiete and smuggled 3,000 bottles of scotch that we'd bought in Cristobal, Panama, into Papiete without getting caught. I didn't know anything about that, but here I was on a smuggling boat. They tell me about 2 days at sea.
3,000 bottles?
No, I know it doesn't sound, it sounds like bullshit, but I mean, this is the truth. And we had an attempted mutiny on board. We had a Chinese Tahitian guy and a Marquesan, and of course, Larry Muldoon was an alcoholic. He was a navigator, and he dropped the sextant about 5 days out. And fortunately, the skipper had one of those plastic Davis sextants that got us all the way to Tahiti. But we put Larry to bed, you know. But I threw all the firing pins out of their rifles. I heard them conspiring to kill the skipper. And we were all living in that little doghouse up in the junk. And they said, I told Alex that he didn't believe me. So I just took all the firing pins out because they had guns. They weren't supposed to have them. And they were shooting everything that moved out there. And that bothered me. So anyway, got to Tahiti, and then I got there, and they fired me from working on the junk. We were going to make this junk into a restaurant, and I understand it's still there. There's a picture of it on Google Earth somewhere from 5-10 years ago, but with a ferrocement in that hull around it to keep it from sinking. But they fired me, and then I didn't have any money, of course, so I hit them up under the 1897 Displaced Seamen's Act or some such thing that somebody had told me in a bar, you know, and well, it worked. And they had to give me a ticket to my home port. And they asked me where my home port was, and I said, Santa Barbara. And I said, we don't know where that is. So I said, L.A. He said, oh, that's too far. I said, how about Hawaii? So they gave me a plane ticket to Hawaii. And then I immediately went down and signed on to the Flying Cloud, which was the owner of the Flying Cloud was George Walker, and he was one of the original Merry Pranksters of Ken Kesey of the psychedelic days. Ken Kesey wrote the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, if you remember, and several other novels. But and that off I went to Hawaii on the Flying Cloud, and I made it as far as the Marquesas, and I jumped ship, and I hit out with the natives there who didn't like the French, of course, so they were just happy to hide this American escapee from the French because they told me, you signed on to the Flying Cloud, you do not stop anywhere in French Polynesia, you go straight out of here. Anyway, they put me on a ship finally and you know, wanted to put me in chains in their one-room jailhouse and whatever and said, we're taking you. And they made me pay for my passage when I got to Panama. They had one gendarme guy under one arm, one or the other, in my checkbook, and they said, you know, here, you got to pay us back somehow, and I paid them back. And then I said, well, I'm going to take off again. I'm going to find a boat going into the Caribbean. Well, they wouldn't refund my plane ticket because these guys paid for it with Central Pacific francs, which they told me were worthless. So I had to take the plane ride to L.A., and so my cruising days of my 20s were over. That was the long and the short of it. But let me tell you about the Galilee. He made it to Tahiti, and then he tried to dead reckon. No, he tried to navigate from Bora Bora to Hawaii, stopping at the Marquesas. And this is a real story. I won't go into too much. But the guy who didn't know how to navigate, he got to within sight of the Marquesas, and his engine failed. And without an engine, he couldn't do anything anyway, because I don't think he really knew how to sail as big gaff-rigged cutter. He ended up not getting to the Marquesas and going on to Hawaii. And he was 69 days at sea without any food and water. Was he and his young girlfriend, who was 20 at the time, and a guy I'm in touch with today, who I'm getting all this story from, a German guy, Winfried, somebody, I can't remember his last name. So I'm trying to get a story together on that and how it really was, you know, from an eyewitness account. I just discovered this guy 2 years ago, that he was still in the U.S., speak English and so forth. So it's quite a story. And then the boat made it back to Santa Barbara, and they call it the ghost ship because there's all this problem. They blamed it all on the boat. There's nothing wrong with the boat, you know, except it was a motor sailor and the guy didn't know how to sail, so ran out of sails and motor. Yeah. He was in deep doo-doo out there. But, you know, those are the days most of us spend most of the time lost, I think. But he spent a greater portion of his cruise days lost, living skeletons when they came into Santa Barbara. Julian Ritter. Oh. Died in 2000 in Maui. Somebody can look him up if they want. It's quite a story.